funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there wisdom to be found in powering through life changes we did not choose for ourselves? Anna Quinlan's latest novel opens as protagonist Rebecca Winter is trying to get through the night in a shabby rural cottage that bears no resemblance to her chic Manhattan apartment. But with a flagging career as a fine art photographer, aging dependent parents, and a young adult son who still needs a bit of help now and then, Rebecca can no longer afford that life financially, and it turns out she is ripe for an emotional rebalancing as well. The new work of fiction by Anna Quinlan is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. She's in town to speak tonight at 7:30 to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. Anna, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's such a pleasure to be here, Chris, although I'm a little nervous because someone told me last night that sitting down with you is like sitting down with your best friend, and I might say things on the radio that I never expected to say publicly. So if I start to go too far, just put a hand up.
I promise not to try to make you cry.
Okay.
We'll do that. So Rebecca Winter, at the time we meet her, it seems to her that the apex of her career has passed and she's sort of trying to figure out who she is. The money's no longer there the way it used to. And most of us don't assume that at 60, everything will be different than we imagined.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people do find at 60 that everything is different than they imagined. I mean, it's very interesting to me. You referred in the introduction to my last book, which was a memoir about aging, mm-hmm. called Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. And one of the impetuses for that book was discovering when I was doing some reporting for my last Newsweek column that the average life expectancy the year I was born was 68. Which is just astonishing because we all now assume that we're going to live into our 80s, be lucky enough to live into our 80s. So the truth of the matter is we used to accept that at 60 things were going to be different because we were going to be in the twilight of our lives. Now we have an entire quarter of a lifetime after that. And I think one of the things that happens to Rebecca is that she realizes that a lot of her life is ahead of her, but she's not sure she can count on being on any kind of an upward trajectory.
And that's a hard thing to accept. And she makes a radical decision about where she lives. She's always lived in the city and she decides, I don't need this anymore. And sight unseen, she takes this little cabin.
Well, not only sight unseen, but as she says to herself in the novel, because she is a very, very practiced photographer, she, of all people, to have taken a place based on photographs. And photographs that, by the way, leaned heavily on views of the view. And as she says, you can't make coffee in the view. You can't take a shower in the view. The only reason to have so many pictures of the view is because they didn't want to show what the cabin was like, which is pretty grim.
And it's in a location where, like, during hunting season, she's afraid to go out for days on end because without an orange safety vest, she might see a bullet whizzing by.
Exactly. And she is really no country girl. I mean, she's, I think, probably not my first, but one of the few characters I've ever created who is New York through and through, who grew up in New York City, was educated there, has lived there, and knows no more about this area than if she'd been placed on the moon.
Well, I thought about that because I think maybe people in the city romanticize rural life in the same way that people in rural areas imagine that the city is always glamorous and wonderful.
Exactly. Well, the roofer who comes to help her with the animal that has wound up in the attic crawl space says to her that city people watch way too many Disney films and they're always confusing cartoon animals with real animals. And I think that's true. But I mean, I think one of the things that she realizes during the course of the novel is, and for a photographer, this is a hard lesson, seeing is not believing. Her assumptions about this rural life are all wrong. Some of her assumptions about her life in the city were all wrong. And she is requiring herself for the first time in her life, really, to see beneath the surface of things. I mean, I was really taken with the idea that when you take a photograph, and it's true to some extent when you're a newspaper reporter and you write a newspaper story, you sort of see things very quickly in two dimensions. And you don't spend as much time as perhaps you should looking at the story behind the images. And that's what she's required to do during the course of this novel.
I was struck by this. She doesn't lack self-confidence and a belief in her ability to do good work, but she is ever aware that a lot of it is good luck. Being in the right place to use her talents to make a photograph that people will think is really good. And it seems like something that no one else would assume about that.
Well, I think some people would assume that women think that. I mean, I can remember one event. I can't remember what it was precisely, when Oprah started to wail on some woman who had talked about how much was due to luck and how men always say they got where they got because of their talents, and women tend to say that they were lucky. But the truth is, in terms of creating art, certainly photographic art, some of it is luck. And I think that she's also keenly aware of the fact that you know, your work may not necessarily conform to what you thought of it, because as the book explains, she's had this huge success with these series of photographs, largely because other people projected what they thought they were about on the photographs. She, you know, when she was much younger, she took a series of photographs of what was left on her kitchen counter after a dinner party. And she did that because there were a million things going on in her life. She was exhausted, and it was there. And somehow these photographs, and one in particular, which is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs, became kind of iconic. People said that they were about the drudgery of domesticity, and they were a feminist statement, and so on and so forth. None of which she saw, expected, is entirely sure she agrees with, but has been her good fortune. And that certainly feels like a kind of a very weird lucky break.
And she's actually living, during the time she took these original photographs, she was living that life of the drudgery of domesticity.
Well, exactly. And that's why she takes the photographs, because she's not out running around, you know, taking pictures of Sedona or, you know, the desert or anything like that, because she has a little kid. And she has a husband who does exactly nothing around the house, and sort of she works with what she has. And, of course, that's what happens again when she moves out to the cabin in the country, that she comes upon these found objects around the place where she's living, begins to shoot them, and works with what she has.
I loved that arc because she's shooting these things. She recognizes, she can sort of tell when good pictures are about to happen.
Right. I know it when I see it.
Yeah. But she's got an amazing blind spot because it doesn't really occur to her to think too much about where these things came from and who put them there.
But, you know, that's always the case with people who are, I was going to say fetishizing, and that's a judgmental word, but freezing moments for all of us. You know, I often think about that photograph from the Vietnam War, which shows a little girl with her clothes burned off from napalm running screaming down the street. And of course, the more time you spend in journalism and the more you get to know the people that you're reporting on, the more the thought occurs to you, should the photographer have taken the picture or should the photographer have taken off his jacket and thrown it over the little girl to put out the fire?
Yeah.
So there's always this sense of the photograph being both a moment in time and to some extent a distancing. I mean, let's not forget that photographers have a machine up to their face in between them and the people that they're shooting pictures of. So that's by its very physical nature distancing. So it would hardly be surprising if that were the effect of the photographs they take. And I think it's a huge step forward for Rebecca by the end of the novel that she has stopped merely seeing her photographs as photographs and started to think about what they mean emotionally, not only to her, but to the person who put the objects there in the first place.
The money aspect of this is very interesting as well, because there are people out there who are still wearing the same amazing clothes that they had 2 years ago and maybe still own that great apartment or great house somewhere. But, you know, beneath the surface are she's literally like she gets $1,000 prize for something, which was money she would have spent before, I guess, on a handbag or something. And she's grateful for it because it's going to pay her father's, you know, bill for the month. And I thought about that and the ways that we almost politely stay away from asking our friends if they're struggling, right? Because it almost seems like something that we shouldn't bring up if it seems that someone is in that position.
And also, isn't it interesting that we almost never write about it in fiction? Because some of the great novels of the past, which I love, actually are about money. I mean, The House of Mirth and The Age of Innocence are both about money. The Forsyte Saga is always about money. Downton Abbey is frequently about money, and Lord Grantham worried that he can't hold on to the estate. Maybe we think that running out of money is the purview of the past or the English. But as you said, I think it's a constant at this moment in time. I mean, I remember talking to someone who is in Greenwich, Connecticut, and runs a financial business about Greenwich. And he said, it's a Potemkin village at this point. He said, I know so many people who are living on loans and maxing out their credit cards and yet driving the Jaguar and living in the McMansion and all the rest. We've passed through this incredible age of conspicuous consumption where the houses couldn't get any bigger. And, you know, the handbags, I mean, people buy $2,000 shoes. How is that even possible? But I do think that there is a syndrome, particularly among women of a certain age, where you know, the prosperity starts to ebb, the money starts to run out, and it becomes, as it is in this novel, an omnipresent worry. I mean, there are times throughout the novel where all she does is do math in her head. You know, this the rental I'm getting on the New York apartment, the rental I'm paying on the cabin, the nursing home fees for my mother, the insurance on the car, maybe I'll sell the car, that sort of thing. And I think there's a lot more of that going on than we know.
And she's still occasionally helping her son, who's 28. And it's interesting because she does not only does she not resent that, and we don't get the impression that he asks for a lot of money, but she simply still wants to help him. And there's that sense that you can't fulfill this thing you want to do for your child, even your adult child, can be really distressing.
And you also absolutely don't want him to know that you have money problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we have that line from the Bible that the child is the father to the man. But the truth of the matter is no parent really wants to feel that way. Her parents, like many people in their 80s and 90s, have been forced into this quasi-dependency on their daughter. She doesn't want her son to ever feel that way about her.
Novelist Anna Quinlan is with us. Her new book is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. She's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. The event starts at 7:30. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Anna Quindlen, whose new novel is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. She'll be speaking to Arts and Letters Live this evening at 7:30 in the Hortschau Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. I wanted to ask you about this. The story is told entirely in the third person. However, we get mostly the perspective of Rebecca, but there is this one wonderful chapter where we see the world through the eyes of this dog. and I wondered about that and what it took for you to sort of think about human behavior from the perspective of a dog and why you chose to do that.
I actually loved that. Well, I'm a huge dog person. I did a book several years ago called Good Dog Stay about our elderly Labrador. And I felt like Rebecca needs help becoming the person emotionally that she can be. And she's certainly being helped by the humans around her. I mean, knowing Jim Bates and knowing Sarah and Tad, the clown.
I want to talk about Tad in a minute.
Okay. Has definitely enlarged her world and helped her to be less buttoned up than she was in lots of ways. But the dog is way outside her comfort level. And as she says, she always said she wasn't a dog person. But in the way of dogs out in rural areas as opposed to city dogs, which is a whole different thing. He's kind of inexorable about hanging around, and eventually, I think, becomes really a part of her life in a way that made me happy and makes her happy.
So Jim Bates is a person who initially is recommended to her to help her deal with her raccoon in the crawl space problem, and becomes a good friend, and she finds herself. She simply can't conceive that somebody 16 years younger than she is would actually be attracted to her.
Well, I think that she's pretty beat up because she was married to somebody very smart, very attractive in this kind of tweedy English way, a professor of medieval erotica.
Trades in his wives every 10 years.
In New York City, who she's the second one. It's not until the third one comes around that she begins to realize that there's a 10-year plan. And he's really beaten up on her self-esteem. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't seem to think much of her work. He has cheated on her. He does nothing around the house. And in every possible way, she's been led to believe that she's kind of essentially undesirable. And so she walks into this new life with that feeling and then discovers that that is not, in fact, the case.
Hmm. You say something about women are, you know, it's easy to be exotic when you're young. And if you stay exotic as you age, typically, you're just weird.
Yeah, exactly. People think you're weird and wacky. And that's not who she is. She's very much she's kind of dignified in the way she appears and the way she comports herself. And she doesn't realize that that might really hold allure for a certain kind of person. And I also think that while she's realizing that with her art, what you see is not necessarily what you get, she's not quite sure what to make of Jim Bates because for the first time in her life, he is a man in which what you see is exactly what you get. And I think that's very, very powerful. So many of us, and particularly with urban life and in the art scene, are just a layer of veneer, several layers of veneer. You know, this is a guy who still makes a grilled cheese sandwich with 2 tablespoons of butter and a loaf of Wonder Bread, and There's something kind of charming about that.
So tell us about Tad the Sad Clown. He was just bizarre enough to seem like an actual human being.
Well, he is an actual human being. I mean, that's a weird, weird thing about writing fiction. You're a dreadful dinner party guest because the people that you're really deeply interested in and whom you have something to say about are all imaginary. And so no one else at the table can possibly understand what you have to say. Because they do, if you're doing it right, they become very, very real to you. I'm kind of interested in the kind of people who work as clowns. I have three children, and there were times when we had clowns for their birthday parties. And for some reason, I always assumed that at some level they had become clowns because of something else that had happened in their life. And that gave rise to this idea of Tad as someone who, as a very young boy, had had this setback as an entertainer that led him eventually to clowning and eventually leads him away from it.
How different is the writing process for you, depending on whether you're working on a column or a news story of some kind or a memoir or a pure work of fiction?
Well, I think that you have a kind of an inherent soft landing when you're writing nonfiction, which is, first of all, if you get stuck, you can always do more reporting. Mm-hmm. My late great friend David Halberstam used to say, if you think you've done enough reporting, you're wrong. And so there's always more to be learned. But also, you've got the notebook, you've got the clippings. And, you know, when you're thrashing about, you look over the reporting and it gives you something from which to work. There's none of that in fiction, obviously. There'd better be a kind of an equivalent to a notebook in your head that tells you who these people are in general terms and where you're going. But the notebook doesn't fail you, and sometimes the imagination does. And it certainly fails you faster, which is why when you're working on a novel, you really only wind up, and I say the general you because memoir has taught me that many writers have this same issue. You only wind up working 2 or 3 hours a day because it's not that you can't write anymore. It's that the edges of the pictures in your mind begin to blunt.
So if you're physically writing for 2 or 3 hours a day, are the rest of the hours in that day, I mean, do you sort of think that they're still part of the process if you're walking your dogs or if you're cooking dinner or if you're, you know, doing something else that feels completely unrelated?
Oh, yeah, they are part of the process. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. I mean, I do an enormous amount of thinking about my characters and situations, for example, in the morning when I'm power walking or in the evening when I'm cooking. Now, that's no substitute for real writing. And I say that because people say to me so often, I'm thinking about writing a book. And my blood pressure goes up about 10 points because no one ever says, I'm thinking about doing a radio show. I'm thinking about trying a case. I mean, writing gets done by doing it, mm-hmm. but in chair. But there's an awful lot of thinking that goes on around the edges based on what you've done that day. You know, you start to think, does that scene really work? Would it work better if I did this? She says that, but would she really say that this early in the book? A lot happens when it looks like you're just making stew.
How did you do all that when you had kids at home? Because there's not a lot of thinking time. I have four, and there's just not a lot of thinking time in the day when you are actively trying to, you know, keep little human beings alive and happy and educated.
Honestly, for me, part of the answer was architecture. I live in a brownstone house. Mm-hmm. My office is on the 5th floor. And there were really wonderful years during which my children genuinely thought when I left the kitchen that I went someplace far, far away. After a while, they realized, and I would hear footsteps come up, and I would have to call down to the babysitter and say, You've got to get Christopher back down in the kitchen, you know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, they went to school, mm-hmm. which gave me that zone of, you know, go to school at 8 o'clock, run like hell back to the house, write as fast as I could, go back to school at 2:30. So that helped. But there's no question that when I look back on those years, I am flabbergasted that I was able to write anything or take a shower. You have four? Ah!
I'm not writing, though, just little bits of script. How did you – now, you raised two writers and an actor. Is that right?
Well, my daughter is an actress, but she's also a writer. Mm-hmm. She's a comedy sketch writer. She's on the writing team for a comedy club in New York City. She's working on a screenplay. So I sort of wound up – once she realized that going on auditions in a vacuum was not as good as going on auditions and working on your own stuff when you weren't getting cast, I wound up writing raising three writers, actually.
Did you intend that?
Oh, no. My husband is a lawyer, and as he sometimes says, not a W-2 income in the house. I mean, I know better than most people how tough it can be to make a living. Frankly, I think they thought it was easy. They looked and said, well, if she can do it, then we can do it. And they grew up in this kind of hyperverbal household, and mm-hmm. I think that helped each of them develop a distinctive voice. And, you know, if you've got the voice, then two-thirds of the work is done.
How do you decide what your columns will focus on?
When I was writing a column, it was really either the news cycle or my particular areas of interest and expertise. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I've always been intensely interested in the problems of the poor, homelessness in America, feminism, reproductive rights, race, sort of the easy slots. but during the years that I was a columnist at the Times and then at Newsweek, there was so much happening in the news that I could have written off the news almost every time mm-hmm. I wrote. I mean, between the Clintons and the Supreme Court decision and Bush v. Gore and then Obama and there's just been so much going on in our world.
And now if you are reporting a story, is that typically something that you get a call and someone says, are you interested in working on this? Or do you present everything that you want to work on?
I do almost no episodic stuff anymore. I mean, occasionally somebody will ask me to do something and I'll say yes. Write a foreword to an anniversary edition of The Feminine Mystique, for example, where I almost feel like I can't say no. I'm actually working on a nonfiction book about houses and homes, about how the American home has changed during the course of my lifetime. Gotten way too big. Now mm-hmm. it's getting smaller again. New rooms that we didn't have before. I mean, when I was growing up, no one had a home office.
Or a gift wrapping room.
I think only Candy Spelling has that. You know, or a home gym. Mud rooms. Mud rooms actually were a real thing on farms, but mm-hmm. not in, you know, development houses. So I actually chose that after I'd done a piece for the Wall Street Journal about my generator for their mansion section. And I had such a good time, I thought, I have a lot to write about here. And Random House seemed to agree, so I'm working on that at the same time that I'm working on a new novel.
Is it good for you to have to be able to switch off in the same way that some people read two books at the same time? Is writing two books at the same time something that you're comfortable with?
Well, I can't read two books at the same
really?
Time. Yeah, I'm a very monolithic reader. But switching off between fiction and nonfiction has always really worked for me. I mean, when I wrote the first two novels, Yeah. When I wrote the first two novels, I was also still writing a column for The Times. Black and Blue, I wrote all by itself, which felt like a huge boon. And then the next three novels, I was doing the Newsweek column. And Still Life with Breadcrumbs, I was able to work on its own, although it overlapped some with Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, which was, in fact, a nonfiction book. The muscles aren't so different because from the beginning when I first came to reporting, it was during a time when newspapers were starting to use more literary techniques, more bright writing, if you will, in their pages. And I did a lot of that. But as I said, having the factual stuff to go back to sometimes is a nice change when the imaginative stuff is coming a little more slowly, and vice versa. I like bouncing between the two of them to some extent.
Has it always been easy to sort of switch the voice? There's a lot of humor in this that I would imagine. Maybe there's a bit of humor in the book about houses, but that's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, how does that work for you?
Actually, a reviewer in The Times this Sunday, a very smart reviewer in The Times. I don't read my reviews, but from what I can gather from the people who vet them from me, one of the things that she said was that there was always kind of a balance of the very serious and the humorous in my columns, and that, in fact, the novels had tended to be overwhelmingly serious. And this was the first time when I tried to combine the two again. And I think that's true. I self-consciously wanted to make a tonal shift in this book. And part of it was because of two things that I had decided early on. Because my last novel, Every Last One, was extremely dark. I decided I wanted to write a love story, which I'd never done before, despite the fact that I'd written six novels. And because of reader responses to the endings of my novels, I wanted to write a novel with a happy ending. And when I started to think about that, it seemed to me that it really required a tonal shift, a kind of a lightness of feeling, which is not to say that Still Life with Breadcrumbs doesn't explore some really serious and troubling issues. It's just that tonally it's lighter.
My guest is author Anna Quinlan. Her new novel is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. She's in town to speak tonight at 7:30 to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Anna Quinlan. Her latest novel is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. She's in town to speak tonight at 7:30 to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Have you always enjoyed speaking to groups, and what kinds of things do you like to address when you're asked to give a speech?
Well, it depends on, you know, what group I'm speaking to. I mean, I do a lot of speaking around the country for Planned Parenthood, where I'm on the national board. And so sometimes I talk about our issues. I speak a lot to women's groups, so I talk about the changing lives of women. Tonight, because of the new novel, I'm going to be talking about how fabulous and strange and miraculous reading is, and how a democratic society has to have it as one of its bulwarks. And I really do like it because, you know, most of my time is spent sitting alone in a little room looking at a blank computer screen. So that to actually meet readers, it's just fantastic. And one of the great things about it with a new book is so much of writing fiction takes place on kind of a unconscious or subconscious level. So that sometimes there are themes or connections in a novel that you haven't even fully realized until a smart reader says to you, oh, well, isn't this really about the nature of, you know, connection? And you go, wow, yeah, it is. Thanks.
Did it take you a while to be comfortable saying, I hadn't thought about that, but yes, it must be, as opposed to going, well, that's exactly what I put in there for you to discover.
Well, sometimes you're keenly aware mm-hmm. of what you've put in there. And it's nice to hear that the reader gets that too. But those moments when someone sees something that perhaps you only dimly recognized, if at all, are these great moments of discovery, and I would never blow them off. I'm delighted by them. I immediately absorb them and then parrot them back in the next city as though they were my own. But they're wonderful moments for a fiction writer.
Have you followed specifically the sort of fate of Planned Parenthood here in Texas? It's been a rough couple of years.
You think? Actually, I've spoken at the annual lunch for the North Texas affiliate twice. Mm-hmm. Once the day after George W. Bush took office, I did Fort Worth the day that the Susan G. Komen Foundation changed their mind about their relationship with Planned Parenthood. So every time I come down here, I'm ready for a ride. But having said that, every time I come down here, I'm struck yet again by what incredible work the affiliate does for people who really need help with their health care. And I'm really proud to be involved.
So we heard the study last week that said that abortion rates have fallen to as low as they've been since the early 1970s.
Right.
The question is how to interpret this, whether mm-hmm. that's because of restrictive new laws or not. My understanding is that the study was done by a group that has an interest in promoting reproductive choice. Can you give us some perspective on that?
Yeah, but it's not just the abortion rate. It's the pregnancy rate, too. So I don't think it is restrictive new laws. Here's what we hear from young people. First of all, more young people are saying they're going to wait for sex. And many more young people are saying, if I'm going to have sex, then I'm going to take care of business. I'm going to use birth control. I'm going to insist that my partner use a condom. And many more of them understand that if they make what could be a terrible error in judgment, there is, in fact, plan B, the morning after pill. So I think it's all good news because we as grown-ups spend a lot of time thinking that we're going on and on about being responsible, and the teenagers are just blowing us off. It's going in one ear and out the other. And I think what we find out over and over again at our health centers is that they are paying attention and they're doing the right thing.
How do you feel like your background, having grown up in a very, very Catholic household, has affected your sensibilities as a writer, as a journalist, as an activist?
Oh, enormously. I mean, you know, you can take the girl out of the pews, but, I'm still there. And as I always say, I'm a liberal because I was Catholic and because I am Catholic. I mean, I really believed all of that in the New Testament about, blessed are the peacemakers and the meek shall inherit the earth. And if you have two cloaks, you should give one to the man who has none. And I really feel like the New Testament is a clarion call to using everything at your disposal to comfort the afflicted. So I think it sort of suffuses everything I do, everything I think. And it's really an interesting time to be Catholic. I keep saying that this new pope is a little bit for me like somebody who had a string of really terrible boyfriends and one day said, I'm done with men. And then suddenly this guy walks through the door.
Once you stop looking, right?
And says, who am I to judge about gay men and lesbians? And you think, oh, really? Are you for real? And until I have evidence otherwise, all I can say is, you know, I think the optics can be really important for someone who is supposed to be leading the world's Catholics. And the optics have been extraordinary. An older nun in Nashville has been referring to Francis as the first Catholic Pope.
Well, I think it bears pointing out that many people outside the Catholic Church sort of assume that every Catholic is in lockstep with whatever the Pope says. And anyone who's known Catholics very well knows that that's not the case exactly. But it does seem like maybe people have been waiting for permission to have these more generous feelings about people whose sexual orientation is not heterosexual.
Well, yeah, and I think also they've been waiting for somebody who understood the deepest tenets of the church. I mean, the hierarchy can either get all hung up on its own business, or it can go back to the message of the New Testament. And I think one of the things that you see with this guy, you know, not wearing the gaudy jewels, not living in the Rococo state apartments, you know, wanting to take the van with a group of priests to and from the Vatican and the place where he lives, is that you feel like he's modeling himself on someone, and the someone he's modeling on is Jesus Christ. And boy, the fact that that's shocking in a pope says everything that you need to know about how we've gone down a dark, dark path the last couple of decades. But, you know, maybe we're coming into the light again.
Do you think that Francis is the Pope who will give women truly a more expanded role within the church and maybe open things like the priesthood?
Probably not. In terms of substantive doctrinal change, I don't see that coming anytime soon. I mean, if I had to guess, I would say it is more likely that the church will permit married priests, although that would cause huge structural challenges for them, than to ordain women. In his case, because of the generosity he showed so far, I don't want to use the word misogyny, although I think it has powered so much that the church has done during my lifetime. But custom is so ingrained on this that I can't see it changing probably in my lifetime.
When you are thinking about, you said you're at work on a novel now, and I don't know how much you want to discuss that, but how do you know when you've been playing with ideas in your head, how do you know this one is next in the queue? And does it work that way that you have five or six things that you think you'd eventually like to explore?
No, they usually come to me one at a time. I've been thinking for a while about doing a more expansive novel in which the action of the novel, the characters, and the place where they live stands in to some extent for America and the changes it went through during my lifetime. And that's kind of what I'm noodling around with now. It's pretty early days, but it seems to be coming together in the way that I want. And I think the way you realize you're on the right track is, and this makes fiction writers sound so crazy, they start to take life in your head. Mm-hmm. They start to talk. They have a particular kind of syntax. You start to get a sense of you know, where the characters fall in birth order or profession or the place where they live or the way that they see the world. And when they begin to take on that life, it begins to occur to you that you're on the right track.
So you've already told us that this is a love story and that there's essentially a happy ending. We won't tell everybody how it all works out.
Right.
And,
of
course. But there is almost everybody gets justice, but one character who by no having done nothing wrong to anyone, really has a pretty terrible outcome. And it is, I think it's especially striking when things work out for a lot of other people and not for this one individual. And I wonder about whether it was really easy to put that facet in as a sort of contrast to everything else that resolves itself.
You know, one of the greatest moments I ever had in thinking about what I do was when I was standing with the incredibly gifted novelist Edgar Doctorow at something. And I told him I was going on book tour, and he sort of sighed and said, and you're going to have to go out there and pretend that you know why we do what we do. And I felt such a great sense of relief that I wasn't the only person who felt that way. At a certain level, when you're writing a book and you're living in the world of the book, you're not even conscious of making choices. They just are things that happen. They are the way things work out. And in the case of the character you're talking about, I didn't think it was a counterpoint to anything else. I didn't consider how it was going to end. It just seemed to me that there was a kind of an inevitability about it that was almost beyond my control.
So how does that affect the way you feel about literary criticism? And I don't mean like book critics, but I mean, you know, scholars who are looking at someone's work and what it means and the resonance that it might have.
Occasionally, I find it interesting and sometimes even helpful. Someone like the British writer V.S. Naipaul, or the occasional piece in the New York Review of Books. But I think most literary criticism tells you much more about the critic than it does about the writer. And sometimes it seems to me that they have a useful handle on why writers make the choices or the unconscious decisions that they make. And sometimes it seems to me as though they're very clearly trying to put a square peg in a round hole. I mean, the number of friends I've had over the years who set out to get a PhD in English and then felt the joy and the life of literature being sucked out by literary criticism is fairly substantial.
Do you write book reviews?
No.
You don't?
No, I used to. I did reviews years ago. And what I discovered at a certain point because of my own career was that you can eviscerate the work of 3 years in 3 hours if you're a fairly good and glib reviewer. And it wasn't worth it to me anymore. I mean, people write substandard books all the time. And I know that readers have a right to know that and to know that this might not be the book that they want to spend their $26 on. I don't want to be the person to tell them that because I've had the shiv between my own ribs. Mm-hmm. I don't want to put it between anybody else's.
The new novel by Anna Quindlen is called Still Life with Breadcrumbs. She's in town to speak tonight at 7:30 to Arts and Letters Live in the Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art. Anna, it's been such a great pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Me too. And so nice to have really a thoughtful and substantive interview. You wouldn't believe how many people don't read the book before they do it.
Well, thank you. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.